We try to say to ourselves, this I will do, but the consequences of this I will prevent. I will block it in some way. I will have an unpleasant thought, but I will immediately strive in one way or another to make it difficult for this thought to have its proper and inevitable fulfillment in my own nature. So defense against reaction becomes necessary because of the inadequate quality of the action itself. This breaks patterns, breaks law and order, and subjects the individual to the infirmities which come from what the moralist terms disobedience. Disobedience being violation of the basic rhythm of life. If, therefore, a person having a certain type of daily experience is able to let go of this experience, which is very largely an intellectual emotional pattern, and recognize the importance of the element of creativity, he should and must make something. The word poetry, therefore, meaning to make, implies one of the most important outlets of those who are in the need of creative expression. This is not in any sense of the word intended to depreciate any of the various avocational interests which have been developed in recent years as a means of balancing man's psychic tension. There seems to be no question in the world that the new rise of interest in good music and the tremendous amount now being spent by average citizens for stereophonic sound and things of this nature represents, in total, a natural interior reaction to need. We have come more and more also to recognize that need is largely individual, that we simply cannot tune on a program which 10 million people are listening to and find it always satisfactory to ourselves. Therefore, individual selection in music, as in art, becomes imperative. And out of this individual selection, we have restored what appeared to be a lost industry, and that is the recording and the tape record of good music. We are returning the individual musical reproducing unit into the home. If this be the basic pattern of something, we also have to realize that many so-called avocational interests are merely switch vocations. They do not reach into the core of our need. They help, certainly, as they divide attention away from the source of pressure. But an individual may become hobby-obsessed in the same way that he is vocation-obsessed. In fact, a great many persons, starting with an avocation, gradually make it their vocation. Now, there are advantages of this. It certainly divides what would otherwise be a monorail mental-emotional existence. It gives the individual a measure of variety in conduct. But very many avocational interests do not adequately release consciousness. They do not actually reverse the motion of life. They do not cause the direct flowing from within out. They simply juggle the things on the outside into new arrangements. There is a creativity in making a good chair. There is a creativity in taking a good picture. Many different activities give the individual relaxation and change of perspective. But there is something that is not quite perfect in the fact that an individual who spends all his days in a banking office has no other internal resource except to go home and cut out a bookcase. There is something wrong here. It is better that he makes the bookcase rather than do nothing. But there is something still better that he could do. Thus, all avocational interests which simply direct the individual to another phase of an existing pattern, remaining, however, on the same basic level. Such transferences leave something to be desired. And the something that needs to be expressed is the pure internal life instinct of the person. The moment he limits this life instinct into some craft or trade, he is already repressing a large part of it. His daily life is also repressing most of his creativity. The person today whose job and whose creative instincts are identical is rare indeed. Nearly always a compromise of some kind has to be made. To meet this emergency, ancient man instinctively developed these psychic expressions. He developed the ritualistic way of life. Today, ritualism plays very small part in the lives of most people. Even the equivalent of the last century, the good street parade accompanying the arrival of the minstrel show, this has disappeared. There is practically no opportunity for ritualistic formula in the life of modern man if we wish to exclude the Dodgers and their periodic high ritualism. Actually, creativity or mass association in rhythm, in art, these things become scarce to us. In a way, radio and television have not helped as much as we wish they would. One of the difficulties here is that we are being forced more and more into the receptive field. We sit and listen. We may see, we may hear, we may gain certain psycho-emotional outlet, but we do not participate. We do not move into this rhythm ourselves. We are satisfied merely to be an audience to this. An auditor being very largely a person who attends something, but not for credit, merely to be there. Thus, the motion of our way of life is not to create a self-expression or release of dynamic internal. Compare this attitude, for example, with the Chinese scholar we mentioned, who, having had a very large and important day in some mercantile establishment, comes home realizing that he is following a law of alternation. He is actually following a law of extroversion and introversion. He is going to balance these two. He is not going to run away from one and into the other. Our way in the West is to escape from one or the other. Very often, we cannot listen to the rational conversations of people. They annoy us too much, particularly on politics or religion, where there seems to be no common ground. We are not inclined to be particularly concerned over revelations about trades or arts or crafts or sciences or the rise and fall of stock markets, unless we are interested in these particular activities. But the true form of poetry, representing an interior revelation of another person's consciousness, is of interest to all normal, healthy people. Not because we wish to pry into their private lives. Poetry is not a form of gossip. It is, however, a natural and healthy interest in that which is the internal consciousness of another being. After all, the consciousness interval is the one we have all tried to cross since the beginning of time. We have always longed to know how other people actually are inside themselves. We are locked in our natures, and we know they are locked in theirs. Any bridge across this interval is of interest and value to us. It is also of great social value to us, inasmuch as poetry can become the basis of understanding where all other more technical forms of knowledge cannot break through. So as a sympathetic listener, we seek to sense something of the mood, of the inner life, which lies behind even the simplest verse. Sometimes we find ourselves bewildered by simplicity. Sometimes we are unable to move ourselves into so natural and contented an attitude that 4 or 8 lines of a poem is sufficient to give us a very warm and rich experience. But here again, a discipline suggests itself. If we are unable to find something in that which has meant something to another, we have more work to do on ourselves. The mere discarding of this as unimportant simply leaves us impoverished and with further barriers between our own lives and the lives of others. And barriers also cause sickness. They cause other people to be sick for lack of understanding. And they cause us to be sick because we have not understood. All this subtle exchange of psychic content is perhaps more clearly and more immediately available in poetry than in any other art that we know. It has also been pointed out that poetry has a kind of illumination about it. Even the most conservative critics of poetry have pointed to the prophetic mood of it, that a very great number of our so-called exact scientific, philosophical, industrial, economic facts have been discovered by poets. The poet never knew that he discovered them. He didn't care. All he was doing was expressing the law moving through him. If he was correct, he was an explorer of regions where more prosaic minds could follow. It has also been pointed very definitely to our attention that where a great social message is implied, where it is necessary to lift man from one level of human achievement to another, that a large part of the world's most impressive, inspirational message has come to us in the form of poetry, that it has picked us out of despond, that it has resurrected integrities in human nature, that it has given us hope under great stress and strain, and the poem has become a universal force in the continuing advancement of humanity on all social and psychological levels. Now, our next concern in this matter is, therefore, the effect of poetry as therapy in your own life. And here I think we also have something of value. Recognizing the primary importance of rhythm and of harmony and of creativity, we have in poetry a possibility within the average reach by which the person can create new integrations in himself. If he wishes a form of self-expression that is almost impossible to take away from him, which requires no appointed periods of time, which requires no specialized technical training, he may work with poetry. Now, some poets will say that this is a broad statement, that certain specialized training is necessary. it is desirable if it is available. But on the other hand, it is not necessary. It is less necessary in poetry than in any other form of literature. The great thing that is necessary in poetry is integrity, a tremendous interior honesty. Actually, the release of spiritual content will be as beautiful as our facilities permit. We instinctively draw heavily upon all resources in the state of sublimity. And in poetry, the individual is ineffective, completely so, unless a certain transference of levels occurs within himself. The critic points out that the technical point, textbooks on poetry, all point out that a poem is produced as the result of an integration upon a level different from that of ordinary activity. The individual loses himself in something. At that particular time, a mood comes over him, the mood of the poet. The ancients felt this mood so strongly that they assumed that it was an entity, and they created a muse of poetry, and they dedicated most of their poems to this muse. They felt that poetry arose in a spiritual being, and that a poet was one who was able to sense this being, and upon whom this being bestowed its favors in the form of great verse. The followers of Pegasus, the winged horse of verse, therefore built their own mysteries, their rituals, their rites, and their ceremonies, and they invoked their muses with all the integrity and sincerity of any devout religious group. Their interpretation, however, rested upon this thing that happened to themselves. They felt that they entered temporarily into a curious pattern of unworldliness, that at this particular time something moved in them. Something lifted itself in their own consciousness, and they became united with a sense of interior vision. And a strong emotional factor was present. There can be no great poetry without some kind of emotion. But it was a kind of emotion that to the average person was more clean than the ordinary emotions of life. It was an emotion in which the search for the beautiful, or the effort to express the discovery of value, these pressures became irresistible. There was a desire to share. There was a sense of the spiritual significance, the doctrinal import of this form of self-expression. Also, due to the very nature of immediate impact, the individual, under the tremendous impact of a total reality, has always been described as speechless. The faculties of great oratory disappear under the impact of a tremendous emotional fact, a revelation of life itself. Immediately, the mind, having experienced this, has the instinct to give it, to share it, to express it, to release it into environment. And immediately also discovers the hopeless inadequacy of words. In this dilemma, and it is the dilemma of great poetry, that which is not available in the term of word is made partly available through interval. Pythagoras pointed out that the music of the spheres was not generated by the planets, but by the intervals between them. And in poetry, we have a certain sublimity bestowed by interval and meter. we have certain use of pattern to make up for the inadequacy of word. A mystical experience in itself has a certain metrical quality, if we are able to grasp it. Among other things that we sense in mysticism is order, tremendous sweeps of rhythm, as expressed in Milton and in Dante and in many others of the great poets. So we use this medium in part, and then usually a very humble and very simple selection of words. The greatest of all vision poetry, arising from mystical experience, has almost the scriptural simplicity that we find in the words of Jesus. There is very little involvement. The entire sublimity is carried by the order and pattern, and by words used more nearly according to true meaning than in any other speech that we make. So the resulting poem has a curious impact. It has the impact of purity. It has the impact of something of the impossibility of transmission, which itself becomes sacred. It also has the impact of nobility of sound order, rhythm, mantram. And, of course, it has the tremendous strength of being stated in the simplest possible words. The proof of vision is this very simplicity itself. So out of this, man gains a peculiar sense of participation in value beyond himself. And this participation is therapeutic. There is no question in the world that it can and does react into man to cause him to come to a more harmonic relationship with life. In mysticism, then, we do find a strong tie between a mystical experience and the poetic form of recording or perpetuation. We find that if we go deep enough into man, we find beauty. And we find this beauty expressing itself in the simplest forms of language. Now, the words themselves are not any more beautiful when a poet uses them than when anyone else uses them. Therefore, something has to happen to the words. They have to be divided away from common usage. And we divide them away from common usage and demand an entirely new perspective toward them because of meter. We therefore transfer them from the language of the everyday to the language of the gods. And by so doing, they become instinctively accepted by us as having a meaning or authority that is separate from profane utterances. Now, we often speak of the poetry of living, the poetry of movement. We have many ways in which we use the term, but always we apply it to something that has a particular, special, dedicated integrity, moving in it and with it and through it. In our daily living, therefore, if we are inclined to have a certain type of fatigue, if we are inclined to wonder about the integration of our internal resources, it may well be that we could profitably include a certain amount of poetry reading in our list of desirable avocational activities. It is probable that we may first have to read or to become a little more aware of poetry before it is possible for us to create poems. And of course, it is not important whether these poems are ever published or not. We are not writing poems by the yard for a publisher. What we are doing is finding ways of creating release for pressure or tension within ourselves, to move it out, to get rid of it, and to find behind it and stronger than these broken rhythms the tremendous harmonic patterns of life and law and beauty and truth and love. these laws lurk in us. And the most direct way of letting them come out is through the emotional experience of poetry. Now, you will observe that in our modern generation, poetry languishes. It is almost impossible to publish a book on poetry unless you happen to be one of two or three world outstanding poets. Even the greatest poet is very fortunate if his book will sell 1,000 copies. Today we have very little interest in poetry. Poetry, to the large degree, languishes except what might be termed serio-comic poetry. Various little prancing melodies that amuse us or are created merely as caricatures of life itself. We find then a certain fatalism, a certain brittleness, a sarcasm, a cynical attitude toward life, and a group of modern poetry which is distinguished largely for its non-melodic, non-harmonic forms, not necessarily just blank verse, which can be great verse, but poetry arising largely from psychosis itself. We know such poems. We read them too frequently. We observe also that poetry, instead of being as it was to the ancients, a ministering goddess, is to us merely another example of our own disillusionment. Our impoverishment in this form of literature is consistent with the general psychic impoverishment we are going through. We cannot necessarily demand that other people change their ways, but we do know that we have an inheritance of great art, great music, and great poetry. We also realize the possibility that great poetry will help us to establish rhythms, will help us to feel melodic harmony in our own minds and emotions, and that it is quite possible that with moderate experimentation in this field, that we shall also find poetry as a means of personal release, of restating for ourselves convictions that do not mean much in prose. They become too matter-of-fact, too commonplace. But in poetry, they suddenly become divine. And this search for a means of expressing great spiritual conviction leads us naturally into the realm of great poetry. Pythagoras read poems to put people into a more peaceful mood, to direct certain rhythms toward the remedying of ailments. And I think elaborate research could be carried, because the exact therapy probably lies in the combination of the meaning and the meter. There is a meaning peculiar to meter. There is a meter peculiar to meaning. Therefore, when these come together, they produce a strong therapeutic pressure. They give the individual a certain distinct message, a message which is accepted not only mentally and emotionally, but psychically within the consciousness itself. The total result of this, of course, is an immediate experience of exhilaration of conscious value. It causes the individual to sense, under the term of poem, a value which he can accept as poem, because it bypasses his intellectual criticism. It bypasses what he calls fact. You are not supposed to analyze a poem as you would analyze a scientific thesis. You are supposed to enjoy it. You're supposed to permit it to make you pleasure, to make you feel better, to make you sense beauty and value, thus escaping the direct influence of man's sophistication. The poem, if it is acceptable and proper, moves in upon us as a more religious experience, an experience based upon our effort to capture a fragment of eternal beauty and preserve it for ourselves and perhaps rather timidly to advance it toward others if they wish to share it with us. This type of therapy is part of maturity. The individual who is unable to sense such values is simply lacking in maturity. And no one wishes to be regarded as immature, regardless of their conduct. Therefore, it is to be desired and to be hoped that there will be a revival of good poetry, that there will be more interest and emphasis upon this phase of our living, in order that we may sense its help in time of trouble, that we may recognize that its vibratory rates and patterns can be, like all other great art, a form of therapy. Just as a great painting, by its expression of cosmic realities in order, color, dynamics, brings a ministry of mathematical exactitudes to our soul, as great music lifts us into the communion with these harmonic principles which govern all things, so great but simple poetry can also elevate us, but it comes to us in a rather more humble and intimate way. It comes to us so near to home, so within our availability, that it is present in the life of the child. It is present in many persons who have never dared to express it. Let them have the courage to do so. Let them feel that in this form of self-expression, they have a means of both understanding and being understood. That anyone who has a maturity of consciousness will share in the experience of this personal release of good. To make this more habitual will probably be an excellent remedy for neurosis. To make us more aware and continually expressive of beauty will lift our minds from these desponds which cause us to be continual expressors of deformity. The individual who is constantly telling his troubles is not only telling them to other people, he is restating them for himself, therefore giving them greater and greater authority over his own life. If instead of this, he reads a beautiful poem, or recites one he has written, or shares in the melodic and harmonic concepts of nobility which have flowed from the souls of poets and can also flow from his own soul, if he takes these means of expression, he is getting at the totality of himself, the wholeness of his nature. He is not correcting the momentary headache. He is correcting the cause of all headaches. He is not merely solving the imminent crisis in his family. He is reaching into the source of all crisis and trying to make it right. For there is no crisis in human affairs that can withstand the full expression of true beauty, beautifully and nobly revealed. And in this type of feeling and in type of thinking, we have the maturity which is necessary to bring security, peace, and integrity to our way of life. Time's up.